fall connection with the, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that, after the Hitler line, the brigade was never involved with Canadian troops. This was interesting in that we did not have to take orders from the Canadian Corps commander, who was at that time General Burns, but took our instructions from the Army, and consequently we didn't have to follow all the intricate rules that for some reason or other the Canadians seemed to set upon the troops that were there. I don't know.
Rules such as what would that be?
Oh, dress.
Oh, I see.
And the way we carried out our work, it was quite different. Because once we got up into Europe, when we did come again to be under the Canadians, as I mentioned earlier, we found it quite difficult to fall in line with all the rules. The Canadians, for some reason or other, seemed to have more rules than anybody. But I guess the fact that we were Army troops and under the command of the Army commander, nobody really cared about these rather minor things. They were, of course, more interested in the grand strategy of the war and simply assigned the armored regiments to wherever they wanted and sort of let us look after ourselves. So that was it was an interesting time and one that we, I think, enjoyed. I felt that we had tremendous esprit de corps in our unit. And I give a great deal of credit to Bob Robarts. I think he was an outstanding officer. We had officers from all across Canada, right from Halifax to myself from Vancouver. We were a very close group. We worked hard together and we also played hard. While there were certainly many, many rough days, as one sits back now in their later years and looks back, you tend to remember the happier times and the friendships that you made and the sort of the fun that you had.
There was something I wanted to ask you, since you were working quite close with the Calgary Regiment. Lieutenant Colonel Maltby was telling me that they had quite a little rear echelon of their own. They had a farm, for instance. They had a farm, for instance, with all sorts of livestock that they carted around with them, and they'd over-ordered on their ammunition supply so that they had a considerable ammunition reserve built up. Did you know anything about this when you were supporting
them? No, but I can believe it. This brings me back to a couple of things that maybe would be of interest, that we too had some livestock in terms of Christmas turkeys. When we were in Italy, notwithstanding the Italians were now on our side, I must admit we looked down on them and we had no compunction about liberating things from the Italians. And as Christmas approached, I recall that we liberated a number of turkeys, which we put in a makeshift cage made of camouflage nets. One morning, we woke up and the turkeys were gone. It just happened that at that time we were working with the Gurkha Regiment, and obviously they had stealthily come in and taken our turkeys. So we had to quickly liberate more for our Christmas dinner. That Christmas we were up facing Borgo San Lorenzo. We were up in Borgo San Lorenzo, and I was amazed at the inventiveness of Canadian troops. I had no idea how they were going to cook the turkeys because we were 75 people in my platoon, so that takes quite a bit of cooking. What they did was they split grease barrels, which were small metal barrels, lengthwise, cleaned them out, and used them as baking pans. They used the stove, if you will, or the oven, I should say, in the farmhouse where I was staying, which was a stone oven, and in which you put great piles of brush and lit and made a tremendous heat where the stones actually got red hot, and then you quickly swept it out and put the turkeys in and cooked them that way. I felt this was quite a remarkable a feat. But actually, I think, as I mentioned, the Canadians were very inventive. The issue for cooking for 75 people in a platoon was a gas burner and two pots. This meant that you could have something like a stew and tea for a meal. This wasn't satisfactory to the Canadians, and so they invented a stove by taking a piece of half-inch armored plate from, say, an old bridge or an old tank, and bricking it up, putting a chimney at one end. At the other end, they would take two jerry cans, one full of diesel fuel, of which we carried for the brigade, and one of water, and ran the water and the diesel fuel down copper tubes onto a steel plate at the entrance to the stove, and ignited it. And as the water hit the hot plate, it exploded the diesel fuel and made it very similar to an oil-fired furnace.
Quite remarkable.
It really was remarkable. And because we would make these about 6 feet long, we could cook a fair variety of food, which was always more palatable than just having one course. If we seemed to be staying in one spot, as we did quite often for several weeks, I had an Irish chap at our headquarters, in a platoon headquarters, who had been a bricklayer in Ireland, and he would get a 45-gallon drum and brick it up and make an oven at the end of one of these stoves, and the cook would make baked things like bread or pies and that sort of thing, which was quite a use. That's why I say I always felt the Canadian soldier was a pretty inventive guy. I mentioned earlier the making of stoves for the tents out of ammunition boxes and this sort of thing. That I suppose necessity is the mother of invention, but these fellows never seemed satisfied with just the issue, but wanted to improve upon it all the time. The only other incident involving livestock was when we first moved up into the Nijmegen area. We actually moved to a place called Kleve, which was in one corner of Germany, and it was the only time I was ever in Germany. And I had to sleep outside that night in my sleeping bag, and early in the morning some of the men came around and told me that they had liberated a cow, and so we had fresh beef for several meals following that. But our fellows had no compunction about liberating things. Another instance of liberating, I recall, was in another platoon, a small Fiat car showed up. This was when we were just north of Rome. It was, in quotes, owned by two of the soldiers in another platoon, which they were very proud to ride around in, and they put the company signs on it, and so on. About a month later, a signal came down from Army headquarters telling us that two Canadian soldiers had knocked over a man in Rome and stolen his Fiat vehicle. Barbara Bartz, in his own inimitable style, simply said to the platoon commander, you better get rid of it. The upshot was that the vehicle was sold to two South African Air Force pilots. At that time, the South African Air Force had no means of transportation, and therefore they couldn't get into the local towns, etc. So these two soldiers were taken in and were sold this Jeep, sold this Fiat. Of course, whatever happened after that, I have no knowledge.
What's that real hodgepodge of nationality that you had in Italy? Does that ever cause you problems, especially when in a supply end that you were in?
Yes.
Trying to get different parts to fit the right thing and so on?
Well, we didn't have to worry about the parts for the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
That was the responsibility of the Royal Canadian Electrical and Mechanical Engineers,
yeah,
REME. They looked after that part of it, the breakdown of tanks. With our company, we had a workshop platoon which was extremely well equipped, you know, to the point where they could put a new motor in a truck and that sort of thing. We had lots of problems with breakdowns, particularly my particular experience was when I was moving the ammunition up in the mountains. We would have two or three total breakdowns every day, and it was a scramble to get those vehicles back on the road so that they could operate. But you spoke about working with different nationalities and the problems. I recall vividly a problem we had with moving the with the Indian division. We had to they rely on fresh lamb or mutton for food. They won't eat it if it's been killed, and so we had to transport literally hundreds and hundreds of sheep in our vehicles, and many of our men slept in their vehicles, and so this presented a problem because these damn sheep would foul up the vehicles, and our men just hated it, and we got no help in cleaning them. Once the we had deposited the sheep, then the men had to clean the vehicles themselves, and as you could well imagine, they were pretty foul.
This was up in the flat north of Ravenna, was it?
No, this was between Rome and Florence, in there, yeah. Yeah, in there. No, when I was north of Ravenna on the Lombardy Plains, it was pretty straightforward. It was beautiful country, except the only thing I remember there was that I guess it was the Italians. They had a lot of not drainage ditches. What do you do with the ditch water? To help the soil, you know.
Irrigation. Oh, yeah.
Irrigation ditches. Which did present some problems. I can't answer that because we were so far down the line that it really didn't matter. I think the sort of good thing about it was that we were so far down the line that movement that we would have to carry out was really the petrol ammunition, and we would have to take that forward to the regiment. But normally the regiments would, or the units would come and get the food rations, the food rations themselves. Again, it depended. There would be days, for example, prior to the Hitler line, there were many days that we did nothing because the regiments were complete. There was no activity in terms of fighting and moving forward. And so we had the regiments completely supplied with patrol ammunition, and we had built up supplies of ammunition for them. So that there were days then that, and this I think was one of the reasons that we got this very short leave and could go to Pompeii.
Yet at the same time, on a major move, the problems of moving forward enough petrol and ammunition must have been quite.
Well,
heavy.
Yeah, we had to move enough to keep the brigade, the tank regiment supplied. Like one platoon in the Army Service Company would completely supply one regiment of the brigade, one of the armored regiments. So that there were three regiments: the Ontario Regiment, the Three Rivers Regiment, and the Calgary Regiment.
And that would be what, about 200 to 250 tanks, I should think, in one point.
No, in one regiment?
No, in the brigade. It's
oh all, yeah.
As a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah.
So that's a good amount of fuel to have to move forward on long
yes,
moves. Yeah,
yeah, and it was great that the Germans invented the jerry can, which of course we copied, because prior to that the petrol was, I don't know if you've ever seen them because you're probably too young, but the British Army had 4-gallon tins, square tins,
oh, yeah.
Made of tin,
mm-hmm.
And you put quite a few, as you have to, on top of each other, and 4 gallons of petrol weighs quite a bit. Anyway, they would tend to squash and leak, and so you had all kinds of problems. The jerry cans were far more practical. They were much stronger. You could stack them on their sides. They were about maybe a wide, so you could put a lot on their sides and build it up without any fear of the thing collapsing. It was a very, very useful piece of equipment that
yeah.
We quickly adopted. Actually, the Germans, you know, had very fine equipment. Those 88 millimeter guns that I spoke about were far better than anything the Allies had. They would pierce armor like you wouldn't believe.
Their tanks as well seemed to be quite lots of
yes, yeah.
Yeah,
their tanks were excellent, yeah. Yeah. I can't recall the first kind of tanks that the brigade had. And I think they were British, but I'm not sure, but then they eventually got the...
Yeah, I think the Churchill in England, I think. And
yeah, I think
the
it was
Sherman
the Churchill,
England,
and then
yeah.
They got the Sherman tank.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, another... you were talking about working with various groups and so on. Again, just north of Rome, the army commander supplied the brigade with a mobile artillery regiment. Not a regiment, no. It would be a...
Just a battery?
Squadron, I guess.
Squadron, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not up on artillery. I forget. The battery's the smallest, and then...
Mobile artillery worked differently sometimes. That was
yeah.
Hard to say what it might
anyway,
be. Yeah.
They were mobile artillery, and we had a British captain and a British lieutenant attached to us, and they were good fellows. The lieutenant was an interesting fellow. He had been the secretary of the Duchy of Cornwall, which is
oh,
the
yeah.
Prince of Wales duchy.
Mm.
But he was he wasn't a teetotaler, but he only drank beer, and we didn't get very much beer occasionally. And I recall an incident. It was my birthday, which is in July, and we had a big American tent as our mess. And Bob Robarts was not averse to... we carried the rum for the brigade,
mm-hmm.
And it could only be issued on the orders of the brigade commander. And it came in gallon crock jars with a small neck and a cork, which was sealed with sealing wax. And came two in a box. a box of two, which was, and they were immersed in sawdust. Anyway, it was my birthday, and Bob Robarts decreed that we could open one of these jugs of rum, and somebody, I forget who it was quite skillful in knocking the neck of the bottle, thus not breaking the seal, and then you could return the broken bottle with the seal intact, and that was breakage. Anyway, we had quite a party, and the next day this British officer informed us that he thought that our mess was a cesspool of debauchery. I always remember his comment. And the other thing I remember about him is that shortly after that, we found that the Italians grew corn for fodder for their cattle, but however, corn was pretty tasty for Canadians, and so we were eating corn most every day. And at first, this young officer poo-pooed it, saying that was, I think they called it maize in England, I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
and that was cattle fodder, and he would have no part of it. However, we persuaded him to try it, and in a day or two, we were around at their digs, and here was this fellow with a four-gallon can full of corn over a fire, and he was just eating it like mad. He was quite enjoying it.
Some people I've talked to have mentioned with more varying degrees of bitterness British senior officers who all seem to be stuck in about 1890 coming around and giving them another ludicrous orders. Do you ever have problems like that with the British senior officers?
No. I really had no contact with British senior officers. The only thing that strikes a note with me now is when we were moving from the Ortona sector over to the Valley of the Volturno, this whole brigade was moving, which is a lot of tanks and vehicles that strung out for many miles. And somewhere in mid-Italy, and I can't tell you where, about six military police on motorbikes came towards us and signaled us all to get off the side of the road. And following these outriders came a jeep with a huge sign saying, "Make way, GOC&C, First Canadian Corps." And then following that was a big limousine with General E.L.M. Burns in it, and then more outriders. It was a real parade.
Mm-hmm.
And this I remember quite vividly. And it wasn't, again, north of Rome. Bob Robarts and I were going out to visit one of our platoons for some reason or other, and we were driving down the road, and a jeep approached us with a driver, and the occupant was General Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
And he waved and we waved, which was such a tremendous contrast to the parade that the Canadian general had as against the British field marshal, who was a very relaxed, low-key guy. No, I never had a... as I say, this British captain and lieutenant were, of course, they didn't have any command over us, but they were just great to get along with. But I really had no, or we don't, that I recall, have any contact with senior British officers. Because I guess the thing was that being an independent brigade, we would get orders through the brigade commander or through the brigade headquarters, and maybe they had to deal with British officers. I suppose they did. At that time, the brigade commander was Brigadier Bill Murphy, who was a lawyer from Vancouver, and who has since died. But again, I think a very capable... the first brigade commander was General Worthington, but they decided that I think he was too old.
He went up to Major General, I guess.
Later came to some
mountain reef in Normandy.
But I think they felt he was too old to take the brigade to Italy, and they moved him out and moved him up, I guess. But Murphy stayed with the brigade the whole time, I think a very capable capable officer. Well, I don't know whether there's anything more I can tell you, unless
I think that's a pretty good summary of it all.
Well, you tell me now. What are you going to do with all this stuff?
Well, this goes into the library, are you there?